Chapter 41 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 41. About 2 months after Crossland's acquittal, I think it was in October 1914, I returned to England. I saw that it was useless for me to stay any longer at Boulogne. When the war broke out, I saw the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders land at Boulogne. They were the first regiment to arrive. I was mad to go to the front, and I wrote to Lord Kitchener, with whom I had a slight personal acquaintance. I had met him in Egypt when I was a boy, staying with the Cromers, and again at lunch at Lady Henry Gordon Lennox's at Prince's Gate, when he had paid a lot of attention to me, and after lunch asked me to walk with him across the park. I begged him to find something for me. I told him I spoke French like a Frenchman, and might be useful in that way. He replied at once, saying that he much regretted that he was unable to find anything for me at present. When you come to think of it, it was not very easy for him to give a commission to a man who had 3 warrants out for his arrest, but I was much disappointed. I saw our magnificent First Army go off to the war, and alas, precious few came back as they went. I thought of joining the Foreign Legion, and wrote to my friend Taffy Lewis. Colonel Lewis was a very distinguished soldier, at one time ADC to King Edward, who used to review military books for me on the Academy, and who had been in Egypt for years, and just missed being Sirdar instead of Kitchener. Taffy wrote back, enclosing me a letter of introduction to the officer commanding the Foreign Legion. He had been made an honorary member of their mess when he acted as war correspondent to the Times in Morocco. At the same time, he strongly urged me not to join the Foreign Legion, and said it was a mad idea, and that I would never stand the conditions. No doubt he was right, and anyhow, after a few days' war fever, I came to the conclusion that, as a preliminary to going to the war, I must first return to England and get rid of the Recorder's bench warrant. I had no suspicion that Ross was going to prosecute me for criminal libel. After his crushing defeat at the hands of Crossland, I thought he was finished, and I believe that no solicitor in the world, other than the late Sir George Lewis, would have advised him to take another chance at the Old Bailey. If I had known that Ross was going to prosecute, I would certainly have gone back just the same, for, obviously, I could not go on staying indefinitely in France, and I was longing for something to happen. In any case, I wrote to the Recorder and told him I was coming back, and that I looked to him confidently to treat me fairly in view of the frightful provocation I had received from my father-in-law, who had smashed up my home and separated me from my wife. I also wrote to the police, and told them that I would be on the boat arriving at Folkestone on the following day but one. I must confess that my feelings on the boat, going across, were not very enviable. In fact, they might be compared, greatly intensified, to those which animate the mind of a schoolboy who has been invited to step into the headmaster's study, with a view to assimilating what a young friend of mine the other day aptly described as sixpennyworth of bend over. I felt pretty sore, metaphorically I mean, and very depressed. Crossing the Channel, as I had done 100 times before, always with a certain amount of holiday feeling, seemed now a dismal business. If I had known what was in store for me, I would have been even more gloomy. As it was, I had a black feeling of impending trouble. I spent the whole time of my crossing saying my rosary. When the boat got in, the captain, who knew what was to happen, politely asked me to go off first. A path was cleared for me, and I descended the landing stairs and was accosted by a nice-looking and smartly dressed detective in plain clothes. He carried my bag for me, and was most obliging. He said I could get my other luggage later on. I thought I was, of course, going on to London, but he said I was to go to the Folkestone Police Court to be charged. I did not in the least understand what he meant, as I thought I was being arrested on the Recorder's bench warrant, but he told me I was arrested on a warrant granted on a sworn information to Robert Ross. Even then, I did not understand. I thought that this was the old warrant for conspiring with Crossland to bring a false charge, and that my arrest, as far as Ross was concerned, was a mere formality, and that I would perhaps be brought up before a judge and formally acquitted and discharged. The detective drove me in a cab to the police station. I was locked in a cell and told that I would be formally charged when the detective in charge of my case came down from London, which would not be before at least 2 or 3 hours. I was given some tea and bread and butter and a piece of cake, and left alone. After 2 or 3 hours of waiting in the cell, the door opened, and another Scotland Yard man came in. He said, "I will now read you the warrant, and must warn you that anything you say may be used against you." He then read the warrant, in which I was charged with falsely and maliciously publishing a defamatory libel on and about Robert Ross. I replied, when he had finished, "All right, I shall plead justification. Every word I have published about Ross is true, and will be proved up to the hilt." I felt for the moment rather exhilarated, as I always do when the issue is definitely joined in any kind of fight. I found the detective quite friendly. He had already collected my luggage, and we went off in a cab to the station, where he bought 2 first-class tickets to London. He then offered me a whisky and soda, which I was very glad to get. He would not allow me to pay for anything. On the way up to London, he opened my dispatch box and extracted a number of my letters, most of which had not the slightest bearing on the case at issue. I did not get these letters back till months afterwards, and after making an application in open court before a magistrate, asking for an order for their return. When we got to London, I was taken to the police station. I think it was the Marylebone Road, but I'm not quite sure. At any rate, it was the police court at that time presided over by Mr. Paul Taylor, before whom I appeared the next morning. The police, as always, were exceedingly kind and friendly. They made me as comfortable as possible in the detention room instead of locking me up in a cell. I was allowed to send out for dinner, and afterwards went to bed in the detention room. Next morning I was brought up before Mr. Paul Taylor. I was represented by a solicitor whose name for the moment I forget. He appeared for me only on this occasion. He was very competent, and I think it was Crossland who had sent him along on my behalf. George Lewis appeared for Ross, and read out various extracts from my printed pamphlets and written letters, on which he asked the magistrate to commit me for trial. The magistrate asked if I wished to say anything, and I said, "I plead justification." He said, "Very well. Of course you know that you cannot do that in this court, and I commit you for trial at the next sessions at the Central Criminal Court." I then applied for bail, and the magistrate said, "Oh, certainly, 1 surety and £500. My cousin Sholto was in court, ready to go bail for me. At this point, George Lewis rose and said to the magistrate, "You cannot let him out on bail, because there is a warrant against him from a superior court, issued by the recorder, ordering him to come up for judgment in respect of charges of which he has been convicted in regard to another client of mine, for whom I also appear, Colonel Custance." The magistrate then, with reluctance, and expressing his regret, declared that in that case it was not in his power to allow me out on bail, and I was sent off to Brixton Prison in a taxi. To this extent, therefore, Custance did at last succeed in getting me locked up, although it was only on remand, and for a few days. When I got to the prison, and was shut up in a small cell on the ground floor, I must confess that my nerve failed. I suddenly realised for the first time that I really was right in the trap which George Lewis had laid for me. Here was I due to come up before the recorder in a few days, certain, as I supposed, to be sent to prison by him, and thus placed in a position in which it would be utterly impossible to defend myself against Ross. So I took it that I was in for 6 months from the recorder, and perhaps 12 or 18 more on the top of that for libelling Ross. I realised, not for the first or last time, that it is very dangerous to tell the truth in England. I felt that I was done, and the worst part of it all was that I would never be able to prove that I had told the truth about Ross, and he would be vindicated and whitewashed, and be able once more to pose as the pure, noble, and disinterested friend of Oscar Wilde, in contrast to my depraved self. I went through about 2 hours of mortal agony, during which I called on God and reproached him for deserting me. Though it was a very cold evening, and my cell was far from warm, the sweat actually streamed down my face. At last I looked round in utter despair, and saw a New Testament, the only book in my cell. I snatched it up, and opened it, and read these words: "And when Herod would have brought him forth, the same night Peter was sleeping between 2 soldiers, bound with 2 chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. And behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison, and he smote Peter on the side, and raised him up, saying, 'Arise up quickly,' and his chains fell off from his hands," etc. This struck me then, and strikes me now, as being a supernatural answer to my cry of despair and dereliction. Directly I read the words, confidence returned to me. I did not see how I was going to get out of prison and defeat the frightful combination of deadly enemies in front of me, but I felt convinced that I would somehow be saved. Just before my 2 hours' agony began, I had seen the Catholic chaplain, not the one who is now at Brixton. I am glad to say that I have forgotten his name. He came to see me at my request, and asked me all sorts of vulgar and impertinent questions about my family, why I had a title, and so forth. I answered with what patience I could muster. He then asked me why I was in prison. I told him what had happened, and he said, "Can you prove what you have written about Ross?" I said, "I do not know that I can, but I know that what I have said about him is true." He then said, "Well, in my opinion, you have acted simply out of spite, and you will deserve any punishment you get." To this I made no reply. I asked him if he would give me Holy Communion in the morning, and he said, "No, I cannot do that," and he went away. At the time, I immediately recognised that this frightful experience was inevitable and complete. I said to myself, "Here begins my passion," and then followed 2 hours when I was in a physical sweat of mental agony, compared with which anything that I have suffered before or since was mere child's play. Afterwards I remembered that during the last part of the time I was in my half-empty home at Church Row, I had one day bought, at some Catholic church, a little book called The Holy Hour. It described a form of devotion which consisted in offering oneself to suffer 1 hour with Christ in his agony and passion. At the time I was very devout, as indeed I remained from that time on for many years, going to Mass and Holy Communion always every day, if it was possible to get to a church. The idea of this devotion fascinated and took hold of me, and I prayed hard that I might suffer with Christ, be betrayed by all my friends and those whom I loved, except my mother, and taste all the bitterness of his passion. This experience in Brixton Prison certainly was part of the answer to my prayer. After it was over, I felt quite calm. I stayed 5 days in Brixton, and was then taken first to the police court and then on to the Old Bailey. To my great joy and consolation, Olive turned up and accompanied me to the Old Bailey. We drove across London holding hands, under the benevolent eye of a warder. Olive accompanied me to the corridor on the first floor, outside the courts, and while we were there together, her father and Admiral Sir Reginald Custance suddenly appeared before us. When they saw her with me, they were livid with rage, and Sir Reginald rated my wife in a loud voice, and quite in the good old quarter-deck and grand old English gentleman, all of the olden time, style, bless him. However, further bitter disappointments were in store for them, for the good old recorder, may his soul rest in peace, merely pretended to be very angry, snorted quite a lot in the most approved style, and spoke to me with awful severity, exactly as if I were a little boy who had been caught stealing the jam. In the end of all this by-play, and after saying solemnly, "The question is now, what is to be done with you?" he bound me over again with 2 sureties, to the disgust and indignation of the Custances and George Lewis. I had already provided myself with 2 sureties, in anticipation of a possible miracle, my cousin Sholto and an Anglican parson, the Reverend James Mills, who came out of the void, evidently sent along by Providence, and offered in the kindest and most generous manner to go bail for me to any amount. My counsel was Mr., now Sir Henry, Curtis Bennett, who did the apologising to the recorder in the court very gracefully, and, as it appears, evidently successfully. Thus the snare was broken, and I was delivered quite as effectually as St. Peter was delivered by the angel. Really, from this moment, I never looked back, except for 1 relapse which I shall presently describe. For although I was committed for trial, and had only about 5 weeks in which to get evidence against Ross, with the alternative of anything from 6 months to 2 years' imprisonment, I felt perfectly confident. Although I had been bound over with 2 sureties of £200 each, and although my 2 sureties were waiting to enter into their recognizances in court, I did not, after all, get out that night. Sir George Lewis somehow contrived that the police, that is to say, the detective in charge of the case, should refuse to accept my Anglican friend as a surety without 24 hours' notice for investigation. Mr. Mills offered to take the police to his bank and show them that his balance there was more than 5 times as much as the sum for which he had gone surety, but the detective refused and said he must make inquiries at his domicile next day. The effect of this was, of course, as was intended, that instead of being let out at once, as was the recorder's intention, I was kept in custody as a convicted prisoner. My sentence was to be bound over with 2 sureties, or in default of producing sureties, 6 months' imprisonment. So at 7 o'clock that evening, after I had been shut up in a cell for several hours, I was told that my sureties would not be available that night, and that in the meanwhile I was a convicted prisoner, with nominally 6 months to serve, and must go to Wormwood Scrubs. So off I went in the Black Maria, with about 12 other convicted prisoners, all of whom were handcuffed. I was exempted from this in consideration of the fact that I was only bound over and due to go out next day. On the way to the prison, we were allowed to smoke cigarettes and talk. We drove right down Piccadilly. It was a curious sensation to look out through the chinks of the cover of the sort of wagonette we occupied and see the clubs and restaurants and the people going out to dinner. This particular Black Maria was not a regular one divided into cells, but I may say, with satisfaction, that I had then, and have since, been in a proper regulation Black Maria. When we got to Wormwood Scrubs, the ceremony of reception took at least 1.5 hours. All our clothes were taken away, and we were sent one by one into 3 or 4 bathrooms, which contained warm water baths. When my turn came, the reception officer, a delightful Irishman, full of jokes and good humour, and doing his best, in the most charitable way, to cheer everyone up, looked me over casually and said, "You needn't have a bath, you were quite clean." I was much upset and said, "Oh, but please let me have a bath, I've been in Brixton for 5 days without one." The officer, in prison the warders are always called officers, said, "Well, of course, you can have one if you like." So I got my bath and enjoyed the hot water, and was lying luxuriously in it when a prisoner in prison clothes, who was helping in the reception, looked in and said, "Get out quick, kid, you're only allowed 5 minutes." He gave me a towel. After that I was inspected by the doctor. The same doctor was at the prison 10 years later when I revisited the classic shades of Wormwood Scrubs, Dr. Watson, kindest and most considerate of men, who always had a kind word for me and lent me books, with the approval of the Catholic chaplain, when I was in hospital. All this took much longer than one would suppose. We were also given cocoa and bread, quite uneatable and as hard as a brick, and then conducted to our respective cells. I was put on the second and top floor of the sinister and forbidding-looking iron and steel house, smelling strongly of gas, with its rows and rows of numbered cells, to which I was destined. I was in the 3rd, or hard labour, division, and I must, therefore, I imagine, have been in the same building where Oscar Wilde had been confined. I thought of him as I went to bed, a plank bed and no mattress, and said to myself, "Poor Oscar, however did he manage to stand this for 2 years?" That was the first time I'd had a comparatively soft thought about him since I read the unpublished part of De Profundis. End of chapter 41.